Accession number 28198, reel 4.
Who happened to be one of the merchant magnates from Kuala Lumpur said, "Good oh, let's make cement with it." So the 60 or 70 men who all discovered that their bags of cement were rock phosphate proceeded with great gusto to mix sand, stone and rock phosphate, and they laid a beautiful godown floor of large dimensions and went home very happy to tell everybody else what had happened. And the next day, when the same unit went down again, the go-down floor, as they're called there, was still all wet and mushy. So there was one Japanese engineer, private or something like that, who was in charge of the operation. He looked at it, and he went and called a Japanese engineer sergeant. And how he became a sergeant, no one will ever know. He came and looked at it and prodded it, and it was wet and soft. He went and called a Japanese engineer officer, who was also extremely puzzled why the cement hadn't set. So he went and called a senior officer, the rank of whom I've never been able to discover, but he'd be a major or a lieutenant colonel or something like that, I suppose. And he came and he prodded it with his stick, and he frowned and swore in Japanese, I suppose, and ended up with the dictum, "British cement no good-o, take it all up." The troops were nearly hysterical by this time, because they'd spent a whole day laying this go-down floor, and now they had the great job of digging it all up and trying to wash the rock phosphate and stuff out of it. Every now and then a senior Japanese officer would come to inspect the prisoners of war camp up country. And on this occasion, it is different, because previously, when a Japanese senior officer was inspecting the camp, all prisoners of war were told to go into the barracks and stay there and not appear. On this occasion, we were trained to do exactly the opposite. We all had to be on jobs. And we all were taught how to report what we were doing, or this rather the officer who was in charge of the particular job was taught how to report how many men he had and what he was doing and possibly why he was doing it in Japanese, not in English. On this amusing occasion, it is a Japanese colonel who came round, and one really wants to picture it. I mean, the ridiculousness of the Japanese senior officer with his large sword that was about as big as himself and his suite, and walking up to where a party were working, and he would expect the officer in charge of the working party to get his men all lined up and salute smartly in the best Japanese fashion and bow to him, and then say, "I have six officers," there were on this occasion, "cleaning out the perimeter drain," which is about a meter wide and a meter deep, with the earth thrown outside and the bamboo fence on the overburden. But all this had to be said in Japanese. The officer in charge was a young British artillery major who, in his excitement of the moment, forgot the Japanese part of it, which started off six officers doing whatever it was in Japanese, I don't know. And he started off correctly. Sichi Shoko Shoveling Shitsa. And of course, the Sichi was the six and the Shoko were the officers. But after that, the wretched five officers who were listening to it, standing strictly at attention, nearly burst with hysterics. That's the only reason that I remember to count up to six in Japanese, incidentally. One time I could count up to 1,000, but I could never forget the Sichi Shoko. Well, that story of the Japanese and the perimeter trench digging reminds me of another one that was not particularly funny, just an illustration of the Japanese bloody stupidity. The favourite punishment, or one of the punishments less cruel, prisoners offended, was to be stood outside the guard room for 24 hours. Stand outside the Japanese guard room for 24 hours. On this occasion, it was after a Red Cross present intended for the prisoners of war, which we never got, of some live pigs were sent from, I don't know where, anyway, the pigs arrived in the camp, and one of them broke loose, and from the Japanese compound, bolted into our compound, and fell into the perimeter trench, and which happened to be full of water, and the wretched pig was in dress, so the sides of the trench were vertical, it couldn't get out, and of course the prisoners of war were all for the pig being saved, not because they thought they'd get it themselves, but because the wretched animal was drowning, and four or five men went into the water and managed to get the pig out with the help of others. And the Japanese regarded it as such a serious offence, the wretched pig was made to stand outside the Japanese guard room for 24 hours as a punishment. In the unit I had, which was mixed Malayan volunteers and some Gordon Highlanders, the Gordon Highlanders had all been in Hong Kong, and a lot of them had been tattooed, and one occasion the Japanese sentry, armed sentry, saw a prisoner of war robbing a Japanese storeroom, and being a Japanese soldier, I suppose, instead of shooting the bloke, he reported him, not knowing who he was. But he had noticed he had a lion's head tattooed on his left shoulder. So, in due course, there was a hell of a palaver, and people were bashed. And I was made to parade all my troops for inspection as to who had a lion's head tattooed on the left shoulder. And my own volunteer troops were perfectly innocent because none of them had been tattooed. I've forgotten how many Gordon Highlanders there were dozen or more. And they were all inspected very closely, and the whole dozen had a lion's head on their left shoulder. They'd all been done in Hong Kong. You know, it really was amazing, the bloody idiots the Japanese were. Story of Dr. Dunlop, when we had a typhus epidemic trying to convince the Dr. Death, who was the medical sergeant, that it was typhus and not typhoid. Typhus is produced from rats, and typhoid is a totally opposite thing. I don't think I can make a story up out of that. Except that Dunlop went down with Japanese, the English officer who spoke Japanese, and the Japanese dictionary, and tried to convince Dr. Death that it was typhus that was infecting the camp and not typhoid, and failed to do so until eventually a Japanese medical officer came up, and it had a good effect on the welfare of the troops, because when they decided it was typhus which came from the rats we were plagued with, all work on the railway line itself was stopped, and everybody was engaged in killing rats, and they were killed in tens of thousands. At one time I knew the figure, but it's quite gone now, and it really was terrific. And the troops were all paid their 25 yen a day, or whatever it was, as they would have been if they were working on the railway, and all they had to do was to kill rats. And of course it wasn't long before the troops managed to contact the other labour camps of Tamils and Malays and people who were within cooey distance outside, and they paid them 5 cents per rat tail. They made a net gain of 45 cents. I forgot that. Yes, the Japanese paid per rat tail. They were actually counted. We had the most wonderful radio. I wouldn't have believed it unless I'd seen it. It was in an army water bottle. Now, it was a special water bottle. I'm not quite sure what now. It was a bit bigger than the ordinary infantry water bottle. I don't know whether it was issued to cavalry or something. And that radio went from Singapore right through to the end of the war without ever being detected. And it was very simple, except for the people who made it, I imagine. The water bottle contained in the bottom three quarters or two thirds or something a radio set, and the top contained water, and it was perfectly amazing. We got news of the atomic bomb being dropped on Hiroshima, and like a lot of other of the Japanese searches, that water bottle had been searched. It was always full of water. When we were on the march, it was carried by one of the men concerned, and on one occasion when the Japanese, we were moving camp, we weren't very sure what was going to happen, the Japanese camp commandant had demanded to have a British prisoner of war as a batman. That was intended presumably as an insult. So on this particular occasion, it was rather amusing because there were two dangerous moments. The Japanese commandant's kit, of course, was beyond suspicion. So the camp wireless set was wrapped up in his luggage and did the journey. And when we reached the other end, the troops who were responsible for the wireless set collected it. They arrived early and they were searched. As soon as possible, the Jap commandant's batman delivered the water bottle to them, complete with wireless set. And we were living in tents at the time, and the wireless set was in a tent with half a dozen or more officers. And there was something on the news that was suspected. I don't remember now what it was, but they got the wireless working immediately. They put the aerial up the tent pole, and there were four officers in the tent at the time, and they were listening to the wireless, and suddenly they saw our Japanese sergeant major coming round, and they hurriedly switched it off and kicked the wireless under one of the bamboo bunks, and two officers sat with their legs covering it. And the Japanese sergeant major came in. He was a nasty piece of work, and trying to be smarmily friendly when he wanted something, came in and talked to them in his very bad English. And he stood by the tent pole and he twisted the wireless aerial in his fingers while he was doing so. And the four officers who were in there nearly died of heart failure. When we collected as prisoners of war, of course, there were the Malay States Volunteer Force, the Johor Volunteer Engineers, Strait Settlements Volunteer Force, and one of the members of the Volunteer Force was a Dr. Stanley Pavillard, who now lives in the Canary Islands. He was a volunteer medical officer with the Strait Settlements, and he was in the group of prisoners of war I was with. And he was a most marvelous man. On the terrible march, when we started off marching up the railway line, every stop we came to at the end of the march, I mean at the day's end, Pavillard, with no thought to himself, would have his medical post open, attending to people that needed immediate attention. I know that personally, because I was one of the unlucky ones of a damned clothing contractor who ought to be shot. Just before we left Singapore, we got a Red Cross parcel from South Africa, and out of that parcel I got a most wonderful pair of army boots that I'd ever seen when they were brand new. So I cherished them, because I knew feet would be most important, or expected feet would be most important. And the last, we were then scheduled to go up to Siam. So I decided that I would wear these boots round the camp for the 2 or 3 days we were there, and keep my own well-broken-in boots in reserve. Somehow or other, I never know how, when we got out of the train at Bangkok, my package with my old boots in it disappeared, and I never found them. So we had to start our first march of some 40 miles. I had to wear the new boots, which didn't disturb me before I started because I had got them reasonably well broken in. But what I didn't realise was that the bloody contractor in South Africa who made the boots for the Red Cross and was probably well paid for them, instead of putting proper leather soles on them, he'd put an inside sole and stuffed it with brown paper or something, and then put the outside sole on that goes on the ground with hobnails. And by the time I'd finished the 40 odd miles, the soles of my feet were absolutely raw and bleeding from end to end. The hobnails had gone right through into my feet. And when I got to the end, I was very nearly the end, I saw Dr. Pavlard, and he said, "Go into hospital." And I said, "All right, I'll go and get my stuff." And he said, "You'll do nothing of the sort. You go into the hospital now, and if you haven't got any friends who can bring you stuff, you can damn well do without it." Later on, when the cholera hit us, or before the cholera hit us, Dr. Pavlard was the only doctor that I know of in the units with us who'd had the whole of the battalion I was in inoculated against cholera. He had anticipated it, and he'd got cholera vaccines from the Japanese and had inoculated the whole of the troops. And when the cholera hit the camp, he was the only medical officer who was apparently able to treat him. Apparently water is one of the most important things, and he rigged up sterilizing equipment with bamboo tubes and stethoscope tubes and all sorts of anything, everything he could think of. And he lived in the camp, was in two bits. There were the suspects, of whom I was responsible for, and the people who were actually in what was called the death camp, where they were admitted, and if they lived for, I've forgotten now, a number of days, they were fairly safe. Otherwise, it was a pretty quick end. I know of one officer that I have a vivid recollection of, who lived in my tent, an English artillery officer. When we went to bed at night, he was perfectly well. He was dead at 4 o'clock the following afternoon, and the fault was entirely his own, because we had very strict disciplinary measures about it, if you call them disciplinary warnings. He had eaten uncooked fruit with his fingers. Now, it may sound ridiculous, but when in that cholera camp, when we went to eat, every man had to take his mess tin and knives, forks and spoons and dip them in a boiling big oil drum of furiously boiling water. Whether that did any good or not, I don't know. I mean, it was only a dip. But there were only men that I was responsible for. It was this English artillery officer who lived in the same tent, had nothing to do with him, who broke regulations by eating uncooked fruit. One of my own volunteers, who I was told afterwards had eaten fish that he got someplace or other and cooked and eaten it with his fingers. After the war, when, after the Second War, when I returned to the estate, and there was a lot of trouble with Chinese communists, and they were called Powangs. They were sort of priests rather than witch doctors, and there was one man in the district I was in who was giving protective wishing protective spells on people. And it is a remarkable thing that on my neighbor's estate, which is next door to Jerome Padang, one of his laborers had been to this Powang to get protection. And I don't know this from personal knowledge, but I'm quite sure the story I was told is true. This man was shot 3 times by one of the communist raiders. His clothing was torn and his skin wasn't broken. And that same man, when the trouble started, he lived quite close to me. He had his wife and a little girl of 2, and I was in the lucky position, having been an army volunteer officer, and when the trouble started, I was asked to become a honorary inspector of civil constabulary, unpaid, and all I had to do was my work during the day and my special constabulary at night, seeing that the special constables, who were all Kampong Malays except mine, who were most of my old volunteers. I had a very fine army. I asked the Thompsons to come and live in my bungalow, where they would be much safer than in his own more isolated one, which they did. And after I left planting in 1949, I was sitting listening to the wireless, and I heard a description of a little girl having, in Malay, an English girl having been killed by bandits. And I rang up the news station. They said she was 3 and a half. I was absolutely certain, for some peculiar ESP reason, it was Sandra Thompson, whom I knew to be only 2 and a half, and found it was this little girl. Her father and mother had gone to St. Andrew's Ball in Kuala Lumpur and left her in charge of the armor on an apparently perfectly safe estate. And the armor had wanted to get something from the estate shop and had taken the car with the Malay syce and the Tamil cook and Sandra and herself. They'd all got in the car and driven down to the shop, and on the way it was ambushed by Chinese, who in their first shot had hit the Malay driver, who had put the car in the ditch not unnaturally. And they dragged Sandra out to shoot her, and the Tamil cook tried to protect her, and he was shot and killed. And then they blew Sandra's head off. I got a photograph of her in my room. She was a lovely little girl with red hair and green eyes.
What about the volunteers? Was it most planters in the volunteers, were there?
Well, latterly, they had.